It's sort of people who regard outrage as an essential daily nutrient. And it's often called political correctness, but I don't think it is political correctness. I've come up with dort.
Ross Stevenson is different, an all-time media superstar who runs away from publicity. The King of Breakfast Radio is a Hawthorne tragic. He writes an annual love letter to footy, and he's got sharp, at-the-coalface views on the outrage that pervades every aspect of social media. He's even developed his own acronyms to describe that outrage, DORT and FOLF, and we'll let him explain that. Ross Stevenson, you speak to Melburnians 3 hours a day. I appreciate for our listeners today for some more talk time.
Not at all, Damien. My pleasure.
The simple act for you now is talking into a microphone. Is the key to what you do...
Not a microphone as fancy as this, I've got to tell you.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What's the difference there?
I think ours are were paid for in pounds, shillings and pence. These look like they might have been paid in Australian dollars.
Okay.
These are magnificent.
And you're paying attention to it there. Is the key to what you do as a rule, Ross, not realising or even treating the fact that there is a microphone beneath your voice?
I think that's what I've always tried to do, is just have a conversation with, you know, Burnzo or with whoever else happens to be in the studio. I remember a few months ago, we got into a discussion about songs that had the word rain in them.
Yeah.
And a bloke rang up and said, well, all my songs have got rain in them. I'm thinking, I thought, sorry, how's that? And he said, it's James Rain.
Right.
And I said... in response, I said, oh, that's right, you forget that people listen. And in a sense, you do. You do forget that people listen. You just try to have a conversation.
So there's people who have a radio voice and a radio personality. What we hear with you is your voice and your personality every time. Is that fair to say?
Yep. I reckon I've always said in the media, there are people, two types of people in the media, those who are in real life like they are in the media and those that aren't.
Yep.
And You know who they are, and some prefer to have one identity. I just find it so much easier to just have the one.
Was there a turning point for you with that part of what you do?
No, not really. I don't think. I mean, it's been it's been a long journey. So it's at some stage you must settle into the person that you are. You don't start out that way. It'd be remarkable for any of us in the media to go back and look at our first performances and think, oh crikey, was that me? That's slightly embarrassing. Whereas now you've settled into a routine and you get reasonably comfortable with yourself and, you don't have to worry so much.
Yeah. Has it caused problems just being who you are and as open as you can be every time you talk?
No, I don't think so. Because radio's still incredibly anonymous. I mean, you would know from having been on television that is a remarkable transition to make, that all of a sudden you do notice that people notice who you are. Whereas in radio, notwithstanding the size of your audience or how long you've been doing it, you are pretty much still anonymous.
Mm. You have
especially if you use a different name.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, again, there's so many ways we could take this chat, and I was going to touch on probably four or five of those things you've already raised. We may as well delve it. The name we've got to know you as, Ross Stevenson, is not your name, is it? It's Ross Campbell.
Yeah, Ross Campbell's my real name, but this is how much things have changed. When I started working on radio, I was a lawyer, and it was considered beneath one's dignity. It was frowned upon by the profession if you publicised yourself and sought any public recognition.
Right.
So you were...
Is that just an adherence to an old school way of
old school.
The profession?
Yeah. Well, look how much it's changed now, where no one advertises, well, more than betting companies and firms of lawyers. But... Yeah. When I started, no, that was considered beneath one's dignity to do that, so we had to go out and find a different name. And the problem was that was on 3RRR, and by the time I got to 3AW, there was a Ross Campbell on air on Saturday morning, so I was stuck with it.
Yeah,
I'd rather wish I wasn't stuck with it, but I am.
Are your children all have the surname Campbell? Or do you?
They do, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, that is firmly drilled into them, that is their name.
Yeah.
Because you know what it's like, you don't want your children thinking that they're special just because, you know, their father happens to be in the media.
Mm.
No, you don't want that.
You mentioned before that it was frowned upon for the lawyer fraternity to talk publicly and advertise. One of your confidants back then, Peter Gordon, is actually that very person in port, isn't he? He's advertising on radio now.
He's now Gordon Legal. And, well, funny enough, when Peter was at Slater and Gordon, the Gordon from Slater and Gordon is not Peter. It was a guy who, unrelated to Peter, who was, I think, killed in the Battle of Britain. Yeah, Slater lived to a vast age and I think was the first Australian ambassador to the Soviet Union.
Gee.
And the other guy died a young man in the Battle of Britain.
Mm. And you mentioned that. Lawyers, Guns and Money was the initial program you had, moved across to 3OW, and here you are 30-something years later, the most successful radio exponent in the history of the caper across the country.
Well, 3OW is a nice place to try to start to do that because it's an incredible radio station. And I guess in the middle of all the digital disruption, little old talk radio sailed right through the middle of it. It's just pure fluke. I mean, it's just the nature of what it is, that in a sense talk radio is the original form of social media. It's immediate. The mobile phone changed everything, of course, with people being able to ring talk stations and converse. They're always able to do it, but they have to do it from home. But now you can do it from anywhere. And if a jumbo jet crashes in Bourke Street, you know, 3OW, I'll tell you a story. About six or 8 weeks ago, my son sent me a text. And he said, there's something going on. I'm stuck in traffic. There's something going on in the city. Do you know what it is? And I said, turn on 3OW.
It's the easiest way, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the easiest way, is it? Turn on 3OW and you find out what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like I've drunk the purple cordial, but it's a great radio station.
The social media component to what you do, Ross, it's a threat to so many parts of industry and media by way of competition, and yet your description of it there as the original form of social media, it is so apt, isn't it, as to what talkback radio was, is, and will forever be.
Yeah, especially thanks to the internet, especially thanks to mobile phones. You know, we often get calls most morning. There is police activity. They'll tell us exactly where it is. We have to ring the police and say, "Now, listen, we don't want to put any police members' lives at risk here. If you know Chris, the criminal's listening and doesn't realise that the police are about to come through his bedroom window." But you know, we get that all the time.
Is the outrage component to a talkback or social media part of life now, the change you've noticed? We need to be outraged instantly and to levels of 11 out of 10?
Yeah, I've been searching for a word for it. It's sort of people who regard outrage as an essential daily nutrient. And it's often called political correctness, but I don't think it is political correctness. I've come up with DORT, D-O-R-T, the death of rational thought.
Okay.
That people make assertions and it gathers a life of its own and you think, hang on, that's just not right. That doesn't proceed from a rational basis. But as Winston Churchill said, a room is halfway around the world while the truth is getting out of its pyjamas for the day.
And do you find too, because you're exposed to it on a daily basis, the DORT, the death of rational thought, sometimes can last and can be a conviction of the person saying it for all of 20 minutes until something else falls
up? Yeah. Well, I had it down to two expressions. One was DORT and the other was FOLF. But FOLF sounds like you're saying false with a lisp, but I'm not. Fake outrage looking for a temporary home. I think a lot of it, the outrage is fake,
yeah.
And it'll, as you quite rightly say, it'll last until the new one comes along.
I think I like the FOLF better, actually.
FOLF is good.
Yeah.
As long as you make it clear you're not sort of saying it with a lisp. But yeah, FOLF is better than DORT. Better than DORT.
DORT, yeah. It's fair to say there's a fair bit of FOLF in football and media and industry all attached to it?
Oh, Lord, yeah.
Where do you want to start there?
Hey, look, for example, given the case of the person spitting at Marvel Stadium, right, now, does that fit the previous week's narrative of don't tell me what I can and cannot do at the football?
Here we go, yep.
Right?
Yep.
Because that was what the narrative was.
Yep.
Don't tell me what I can't say and can't do and say at the football.
Yep.
Spitting on people is it's my outlet.
It's my right.
It's my right and it's my outlet.
I pay my money to go through the gate.
Yeah, I pay my money. I can do what I like. No, you can't do what you... The previous week was just...
What was that?
What was that?
What happened then?
Yeah, Sean Carney wrote a great piece in the Herald Sun saying, I know there's, you know, the behavioural awareness officers, but let's acknowledge that there are some aspects of the crowd's behaviour itself which has contributed to the whole problem.
Absolutely.
So following week, someone's at Marvel spitting on people.
That's okay.
Yeah, is it okay or is it not okay?
Where do you watch the football these days, Ross, when you go and play your Hawthorn tragic role?
I was thinking to myself only yesterday, I don't seem to have gone as much this year.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is that because of the five, as we speak, five win scoreline?
I doubt it. It's to do with the fact that I've built a place down the country. And I try to get there as much as I can. And honestly, and I go to the local footy. If we're down there, we go.
Yep.
Right? And it's wonderful. And in fact, interestingly, Sarah, what's the appropriate name? Is it partner, is it? You call someone your partner?
Yes.
I do like the days where someone once introduced someone to Barry Humphries and said, "This is my partner." And Barry Humphries said, "Oh, she's a solicitor." I love it. It's Sarah who's the one who really is 100% committed with me. Let's go to the local footy because you can take the kids there. They can free range. They run up and down all day and get exhausted, which means they go to bed early. The standard is terrific. No one cares too much about the umpiring. And no one seems to care as much about the result either.
Do you care as much about the AFL result as you once did?
Yeah, I reckon I do. I reckon I do. We're not going all that well at the moment, but I do. I enjoy it. And I've raised two maniacs.
Have you?
Maniac Hawthorn supporters, and I think I've got a third on the way, and Will Lauren's only three, so I don't know where she's going to end up.
So the 23 and 20-year-olds are the maniacs you're referring to then?
Maniacs, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they love it. And that's another thing that Sean, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this, another thing that Sean Carney wrote. He says that if you look at footage of a footy in the 1970s, hardly anyone in the crowd is wearing club colours.
Hmm.
And he says, now everyone does. I have never gone to the football in club colours. My two oldest children always go in club colours. I don't know that there's anything wrong with it, but I thought it was an interesting observation. And I wonder, I assume it's true.
Yeah, I think it is. I've always thought there's a stage or an age of life where you can't or shouldn't wear the club colours.
There is clearly an age at which a man should not wear a jumper.
Would it be maybe 16 or 17 years of age, Ross? Because it is in my eyes. I don't know whether there's a reason to wear it beyond that.
Well, I can think of three items of clothing that there is an age cut-off period, and that is a football jumper, a rashie, and Crocs.
You haven't got Speedos in there?
Oh, well, I saw a photograph of Tony Abbott the other day in the paper with Speedos, so yeah, let's add Speedos.
Speedos as well. Crocs, I agree with. Yeah. Yes. Unless you're at home. just with Hawthorn, I had cause once to ring you, it was about 2 years ago, when there was a few problems off the field about it, because your name regularly has been linked to a board role there, because that's what people do in the football now. You become a profiled person like yourself, despite you fighting the profile side of what you do, but media personalities are now the new presidents, the new chair people of footy clubs, and you, I've got no doubt, would have been approached in some form over the journey to be that person, either as number one or on the board. You've resisted to this point, and will you change at some stage if it puts you again?
No, I'm not a meetings guy. I just can't stand them. No, I couldn't. I don't have, what Eddie does. It's extraordinary with the amount of time he puts into it. I pretty much do my 3 hours in the morning and go home.
Mm.
That's it.
That's how you're wired.
That's how I'm wired. I got some people I know who would be good in certain roles, and if they said a condition is you come along, I might.
Well, here we go. You might. You're not really
no. But I really only down the track if some people said that they would be involved.
Okay. Were you close at the time when Jeff Kennett came back, prior to him coming back, when there was disruption? That's when I rang you, and I'd been told to ring you for a certain reason. I won't give up names, but yeah, your name was thrown up there pretty seriously for a while.
No, not even close.
Okay.
But when that coup organised by Jeff magnificently, involving a whole army of people behind Jeff to be the new president, that army consisting of Jeff and his mobile phone, that was it. He just organised it. And,
are you happy he did? Are you happy he came back?
Yeah,
for stage two.
I think he's been great. I don't know whether he now has an eye on the exit. Right. But he's been good, And I think he drives the AFL mad.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, driving the AFL mad, but I think he does.
See, we're talking about him. As we speak quite recently, he made some racial stereotype comments. Yeah. How did you view that, the way that played out, and do you think he apologised enough?
Yeah, I'm surprised. I want to know why he apologised. You know, what was the mechanism behind him apologising? What he said, I think if you know that the sentence starts, "I'm not being racist, but," you know, you're in trouble immediately. It's that roadblock you see and you think, "Oh, crikey, I'm going to drive around that." Mm. There was someone I know recently who sold a pub, and I said, "Are you happy to be out?" And he said, "It's staff drive you mad." He said, "I can't get anyone to work on weekends without a Section 457 visas.
Right.
My business would be stuffed." And I mentioned this on air and got a text from a leading racehorse trainer who said, "Well, I can't get anyone to go to the track at 4 o'clock in the morning without 457 visas to people who work in the stables. My business would be staffed." I would wonder how many of the security staff at Marvel are on Section 457 visas because they cannot get people to work weekends.
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't say that. He called them new arrivals and said, "I'm not being racist." And just the mechanism of him apologising was interesting to me because he's not the apologiser in chief.
No. I think fair to say a fair bit of heat came around the industry and quite possibly from his own club to do so.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's my take on it. Just getting yourself into trouble with words. How have you managed not to, Ross, given that it seems to happen annually for most other people, including myself and stations that I've been with over the journey? How have you stayed squeaky clean on that?
Probably rat cunning. No, I think it is often, I don't know, well, what's the answer to this? I don't know. But often you can spot trouble on the road ahead and you drive around it.
Yep.
Right? So it's
being in the moment.
Not being so lost in the moment that you can't see trouble ahead.
Have you had reasons to think really quickly on the spot? Have you nearly got yourself into some
stuff?
No,
I don't think so.
Just be in the conversation the whole time, which is getting back to what you said at the top about being yourself and being there.
And concentrate, I think.
Yeah.
Helps.
Yep. Back to the routine. So Hawthorn's not as weekly fixture in your life, is it?
Yeah, that's not due to their performance. That's due to having life. A place in the country.
Yeah, yep. Okay. Yep. You still love the club as much as ever. And that goes back to when you went to, just reading up before, Glenferrie State School, which was near Glenferrie Oval. That's the link when you came down from Queensland as a family?
Came down from Brisbane and went to Glenferrie State School. Every other member of my family barracks for Melbourne, but because I went for Glenferrie, I don't know what person it was at Glenferrie State, but I just remember being at Glenferrie State and I barracked for Hawthorn. Maybe, presumably, most of the kids did. I don't know. But yeah. So it's been Hawthorn since then.
And was it Peter Hudson who was the initial individual love?
It would most assuredly have been. I was there the day he did his knee in round one. And I still remember starting work on 3AW and being invited to the football by the club for one of the president's lunches. This is a long time ago. And being there, and Peter Hudson came up and to say that he'd heard something on our program that morning. And I spoke to him very briefly before I left the room, got my phone out and rang Mum and said, "Mum, Peter Hudson listens to our program." I couldn't believe it.
Whole lot of your life at that stage.
Oh, absolutely.
Working life at least.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know him. He's just the most delightful human being and a completely freakish footballer.
Yep. Who did that love evolve into over the years, Ross? Who are the other special Hawthorn players in your heart?
How did you describe that person? Special?
Yeah, there he is. I thought he might have come up there somewhere.
Cyril, I reckon. Yeah. Cyril would be the... Yeah, Buddy, obviously, when Buddy was there. But there'd be loads. But I'm not applying any filter and just say, who's the first person to come in my mind? It's Cyril. I don't think I saw anyone else play the type of football that he played. It was completely ridiculous. He did things with such speed at times that you could only see them on slow motion replay.
Yeah, that's right.
There's an intercept, I think, in the grand final against the Eagles where he intercepts a handball and then flicks off a handball to himself. To him. The ball must have been in his hands for
a split
0.1 of a second.
Mm.
Yeah, he was just magical.
The project you've had for a couple of years now, and it's probably a continuation of one you've had deep down for 30 years, the love letter to footy, the love with footy, love of footy. It's a 4 or 5 year now of event you've been running.
Four, I think. Yeah, just finished four.
And just the origins behind it, just everyone can relate to it, is it? Is that another?
I was asked to speak at the Norm Smith Oration, I don't know, 7 years ago, something like that, and not to give the oration. That was given by David Parkin, but I had to propose a toast to football, I think it was my role. And so I sat down and I thought, what am I going to do here? And then I thought, well, I love footy. And then I just had this idea, it's not particularly original, of writing a love letter to footy. So I wrote a love letter to footy, and it went pretty well. And then the AFL invited me to read it again at the launch of the following year's season, which was extremely trepidatious. And then I thought, well, let's make some money for charity for this. So I mentioned, I think we must have been talking on air about, you know, what are the things you've always said you'd do that you haven't done?
Right.
And I said, well, I've always wanted to have a charity function for Love Letter to Footy. And the Australian Prostate Centre rang up and said, well, how about making it us? And I said, well, you're the proactive one, so yeah.
Yep.
So every year we get five. And what I did when I was organising the planning the lunch was that I sat down and wrote down on the left-hand side of a bit of paper everything I hated about corporate sporting lunches.
Yeah.
And on the right-hand side of the page I wrote down the opposite of that.
Okay.
So they are completely different. They're standard. You know, there's some. If you're extremely old, you can we'll get a table for you to sit at. But mostly you stand up. There'll be food and drink that'll go around, but you can go and serve yourself if you're hungry. If you see Damien Barrett on the other side of the room, you can go over and talk to him. You're not stuck on the same table of 10 complete strangers. No speaker can speak for more than 9 minutes.
Right.
Because we all know what it's like where you go to a function and I say if it was revered, if they found Lord Lucan, right, in the depths of Africa and brought him in for a press conference, after about 15 minutes, people go, hey, mate, wrap it up, please.
That's the time span, you reckon?
Yeah, don't bang on about it. So no one speaks for more than 9 minutes, which also has the attraction of people will agree to speak because they know that their obligation is only to write a 9 minute. All they have to do is write, dear footy, I love you, and then the rest is up okay. to them. And with some wonderful speakers, and it's a really fun, relaxed day.
Yeah, good. And I don't want this to sound too simple, but what is it that you love about footy? And I know it's a simple question, I've posed it there, but to encapsulate it, if you can.
I don't know, but you could be a judge as to whether this is under threat, but I went to Sellers Park in London once to see Crystal Palace play Bournemouth, and the guy in the ticket box said, Palace or Bournemouth? And I said, no, I'm just here to see the game. And he looked at me as if I had suggested we go on a balloon ride together. He couldn't believe it.
A neutral observer.
I love the fact that we're able to sit cheek by jowl. And I noticed that from a game on the weekend. I think Saints Lions. I can't remember which one it was. You look at the crowd and there's a guy in his colours. There's the guy.
There might be someone spitting from the top. But,
but we go to the game together. We don't have to be segregated. I always think back to the 2011 prelim where Collingwood beat us, and I've never been more devastated. My Hawthorn mates say I'm mad. And I remember walking out of the ground and the Collingwood people were absolutely joyous and the Hawthorn people were a bit sad, but no one punched on. So I don't know whether this punching on thing is a new thing after the game, but I always used to love the fact that we could sit there peacefully next to each other and barrack for a free-range game.
Yep. Fair enough. Ross, similar to what we've discussed already about yourself, the profile side of your life, which would come naturally if you allowed it to, but you haven't. Why?
I don't know. It doesn't interest me.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I remember someone who was in the media saying to me once, everyone wants to be on television, and if someone says they don't want to be on television, they're lying. I was thinking, no, that's just not true. Mm. And there are lots of people who don't seek a profile.
Yep.
Lots who don't like it. I can't explain why I don't, but I have no interest in it.
Red carpets aren't your go.
No. I used to go to a lot of Logies because Sarah liked going to the Logies, and we'd try to find ways to sneak in without going down the red carpet because seriously, it just looks ridiculous. When you're not enrolled in television. No, not my go.
No. Contrasting that way of your makeup with your counterparts in Sydney, the Ray Hadleys, Alan Jones, John Laws, it couldn't be more extreme, could it?
No, it could not be more extreme. I say that Sydney and Melbourne are not different cities, they're different countries. And I think they're becoming more and more unalike.
Yeah.
There's almost two Australias, I reckon. The rugby league states and the AFL states are almost two different Australias. And I was talking to – we get to interview some politicians occasionally. I can't remember who it was. Was it Scott Morrison? I said, one of the difficulties is when you're trying to come up with a political message to cover all of Australia, it's now sort of increasingly difficult for a politician to do that because you're trying to send a message that – sort of resonates in Queensland and Victoria at the same time, it can be more difficult than it used to be, I think. I might be wrong.
And you've always and long said that you won't want to talk about politics too much on your radio show.
No, we don't talk about it at all.
People just don't like
people it. People hate it. People find it very divisive. And I always think, when you look at every election in modern Australian history, on a two-party preferred basis, half the people vote one way and half vote the other.
Doesn't deviate too much, does it?
Never 70-30.
Yeah.
Never 60-40. It is roughly half and half. So if you're going to take a political view, all you're going to do is alienate half your audience for a start. And people don't like it.
Yeah. Your outside radio work, you do love food, love wine.
Wine, yeah. Love
racing.
Red wine, love horse racing. I've tried to sort of work out why I like horse racing so much. I've come down to the fact that horse racing people are never boring because it's a sort of high-risk environment.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the people involved. I love owning very small parts of horses and racing them. None of them have been good, but people in racing are interesting. I like them.
Are they relatable more than other facets of life?
I don't know about relatable, but I mean, when you talk about some, like David Hayes as a trainer, he's just a tremendously amusing guy. Chris Waller is really smart and funny and intelligent. I like him a great deal, and I like Hayes a great deal. And there's loads of people in the horse racing industry I like, and I don't know what's happening with racing. Moody Valley's having hundreds of millions of dollars spent on it. Caulfield is. Flemington's just built the new grandstand. They must be doing all right.
You mentioned Chris Waller. His last 4 years in training Winx were stressful for him as much as they were joyous. I don't mean to sound too simplistic, but do you take the same view of you protecting your ratings dominance now that it's into its hundreds and, or what is it now, 126 consecutive, 135 consecutive survey wins, Ross, in a total of 206 survey result wins over your journey? I mean, that's an extraordinary number. Do you have that pressure of needing to be number one each time?
No, it doesn't bear thinking about it. I wouldn't think. I did ask Chris once in a race week how often he thought of Winx when Winx was about it. He said about every 8 minutes. No, we don't think about it much. No. And that's truthful.
Probably don't have to now, do you? It's just going to happen.
Well, you just try to be natural and you don't want to outthink yourself. It wouldn't do you any good anyway.
No, true. Do you recall the first one? Do you recall the reaction to the first one you had?
I do. I couldn't believe it. It's a fair while ago, but I do remember.
Yeah, 1991 or 2 would it have been? Yeah,
90. My father died in. He must have died just around the. I would have got number one after he died.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was a bit.
It's tinged.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the memories of it.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And now that you've done it for so long, the relatability component, Ross, I just want to delve into that with the rumour file that you obviously set up. And I love the backstory to that. You've told it a few times, but maybe our listeners haven't heard it, how you had the idea, you went to Steve Price with it, and just maybe if you don't mind, take up the story from there.
Well, I used to – I lived in Fitzroy in Carlton for 20 years, and I used to go to the Standard Hotel in Fitzroy Street, Fitzroy. As a single man, and that was my lounge room. I'd go there at 5 o'clock. And
every night, every afternoon.
Pretty much every weekday afternoon. because people would come in and they would, from various, you know, rock and rollers, builders, printers, salespeople.
And you'd have a wine or a beer?
Beer. Yeah. And I remember that people would say, did you know that? And I thought, this is what people talk about. So I went to Steve Price and I said, I've got this idea for a thing called the rumour file, you know, where people just ring in and tell us whatever rumours they've heard. And he said, that's the worst idea I've ever heard. We will be sued out of existence within 6 months. So that was at the start of a year. And then in the middle of that year, I went to the States and came back and said to Pricey, gee, I was in America. I heard this thing on radio called the rumour file where people ring in and hear. I hadn't, of course. And he
just
said,
just made it up.
And just made it up. And he said, oh, what a great idea. We'll start tomorrow. And I reckon people could relate to the fact that as long as you tell someone that something is not your idea but something you've heard somewhere else or seen somewhere else, you're far more likely to get someone to say, that's a good idea.
Yeah. It takes a certain person, though, to be able to do that, because most people want credit for the idea, don't they? Is that what you've noticed, too? Or you don't care?
No, I don't care. I can't even remember what year that was. Must have been 91, 92, something like that.
Yeah.
Now having, it's got a life of its own.
Having worked in newsrooms over the journey, Ross, and not always in sport, I can tell you that every newsroom still hits a record button on that segment for various reasons.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah. Proud of it?
I am pretty proud of it, but I'm also proud of the audience because they are not journalists and they ring up and they don't I think a lot of them write down their rumour on a bit of paper and they get there and they read it out and they are incredibly professional and God bless them.
A man very special to you is John Clark.
Yeah.
The great John Clark.
Great man.
The Games was an amazing TV series, which you did with him.
Yeah, and there's nothing worse than false modesty. So if you want to write a successful television series, write it with John Clark. Mm. I think for the greater part of his adult life, he was the greatest satirist in the English language in the world. I don't think Peter Cook, who was John's great idol, Peter Cook would certainly have been there, but John was a genius, and an incredibly kind person. Right. He just helped people all the time. He wanted to help people coming through in his profession. I met him because I wrote a play at a comedy festival in, I can't think what year it was, late 80s probably. It was loosely based around Malcolm Fraser having lost his pants in that motel in Memphis.
Right.
It was called The Trial of Malcolm X. And we had we held it in the Magistrates Court at Melbourne Magistrates Court, and we, from the audience, we impaneled a jury and we tried Malcolm Fraser for stealing a towel. Remember he wrapped a towel around himself? So it was a bit of stupidity, really. Then we had a guest judge, who I think was then Gordon Lewis from the Law Institute, who went on to become a judge.
Okay.
But one night, I think the Wednesday night, we had a second guest judge, and that was Peter Cook, who happened to be in Melbourne for the Comedy Festival, which was just one of the most remarkably funny nights of all time.
Yeah.
All we did was tell him broadly what the storyline was, and he just improvised the rest. It was incredible. At one stage, he reaches down to his feet and picks up a bottle of Tanqueray gin. The reason it was there is because he was drinking it. And he put the Tanqueray gin on the bench and everyone stops and looks at him and he says, he's dressed as the judge, he's got the wig and everything. He goes, this trial is brought to you with the compliments of Tanqueray gin. You always get a result with Tanqueray. And then he puts it back on the he did that about 20 times. Anyway, I look at the back of the courtroom and there's John and I've gone, oh, my God. John Clark's here. Someone introduced me to him afterwards. And then John and I went on to write two plays for the comedy festival.
Did you?
And then The Games.
Yep. The Games, remind me, was that one of the storylines was the Olympic 100-metre track being 96.2 metres long? Was that?
94 metres long, I think. Yeah.
Genius idea, that one. Was that yours or his?
I can't remember.
Take it. Claim it now.
No, I know exactly where it was. We were walking down Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, when one of us had the idea, and I can't remember who it was, but we knew we were on to a winner.
I reckon it's yours if you're not claiming it.
Now, I tried to find it on YouTube the other night, and there's only one, I think a lot of them have been blocked by the ABC.
Oh, really?
And there's one there, but it, sadly it fades out in the middle of it.
Oh, okay.
Because it is just a beautiful bit of acting.
Yeah.
With Mr. Wilson, I should give the actor credit for, I can't remember his name, who played Mr. Wilson, where John is cross-examining him about the length of the 100 metres track, to which Mr. Wilson responds, it's about 100 metres long. And John says, the 200 metres track, is that about 200 metres long? And he goes, no, different arrangement, the 200 metres track. It's lovely.
Did you laugh when you obviously deliberately write something like that into a storyline and then life unfolds in a way that that storyline actually fits?
Yeah, that, I remember we wrote a particular episode where John couldn't remember the names of his children. And I was at a function once, and John Coates came up to me and said, how did you know that I have trouble remembering the names of my children? And I said, John, to be honest, we didn't. You know, it was just something for us to have a bit of fun with.
Recently, Ross, you played I thought it was a great game on your radio show with Glenn Ridge, Personality Soup.
Glenn Robbins.
Yeah. Personality Soup. You needed to come up with three words to fit the characters and the profiles of anyone you raised.
I'm very keen to point out at this stage that that's Glenn Robbins' idea.
Okay, in case it goes haywire, is that?
Oh, no,
his idea.
He needs the credit for it because I think it's a brilliant idea.
It's a great idea. It was great radio when you did it. I got out of the car before I got a chance to hear what I assumed was going to come, and that was you describing yourself in three words.
Yeah, no, I said to Glenn, we'll keep this going long enough so that we'll run out of time before they get to any of us inside the studio.
Well, we've got a few minutes left before we say goodbye to you, so we might go down this path now if I can, and you don't have to if you don't want to.
No. I mean, self-analysis is never anything that I've been good at. Avoiding answering the question, there were a couple of callers who
rang. You don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, a couple of callers right at the end rang in about, Glenn said, what's the perfect human being? What's the personality soup of a perfect human being? And they both said roughly the same thing. They said kindness, intelligence and compassion. Was roughly the two people who rang in. And I had already described on air what I thought John Clark's personality soup was. And I had said kindness, genius and social justice, which is roughly
the perfect
kindness, intelligence and compassion. So I'm deflecting by saying to me that I agree with the audience, that is a perfect human being. And I was thinking, well, what's the best judge of that? It is, that's what you'd like your children to be.
You got away with at answering it.
Thank you
yourself.
Very
so
much.
We'll move on.
I was starting to get a sweat up.
I'll make this quick from here. Could you give three words in this personality soup to describe the AFL as you now know it and football? Or maybe separately.
Football or AFL football or AFL the organisation?
Let's go the organisation first and then we'll finish with a positive maybe.
The AFL. Hands-on. Custodians, adventurous.
There you go. And football would be a bit different. I mean, your love of football is the reason we're speaking to you today, and it goes deep, doesn't it? And it's still ongoing despite its tribulations over the journey.
Yeah. Every time you think, oh, gee, I don't like watching the footy much anymore, and then what was the game on Sunday? Collingwood?
Bulldogs. As we speak, yeah.
I thought it was a terrific game.
Great game.
I thought it was a really entertaining game of footy. Is that the one where the Blacks spat, or was that a different game?
It was the same venue, whether it was that
venue.
Game, but yeah, it may have been a different game.
I still love it.
You still love it?
Yeah.
Well, I love the fact you've been able to speak to our in-the-game listeners today, Ross, and I do appreciate your time because I know that you don't have a lot of it, given you are speaking to a large audience for 3 hours every single day. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Damien. Thank you, Jack, for enabling me to speak on a 21st century microphone. It's a thrill.